Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 41, last half of the chapter, verses 37 through 57. And in this section of Scripture, we will see Joseph rising to power. Our context is this. In the first half of chapter 41, verses 1 through 36, we see that Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams after he's been called out of prison by the Pharaoh's cupbearer and said, "Hey, Pharaoh, I know somebody that can interpret your dreams about the 7 years of famine that are coming on Egypt." That's our context. So now we start in Genesis 41, verses 37 and 38. "Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants." What proposal? Well, that was what was discussed in our last audio, verses 1 through 36, the proposal that Joseph gave to the Pharaoh of taking 20% of all the crops for the 7 years of plenty and storing them away in storehouses to get the Egyptians over the 7 years of famine. So this proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Then Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit?" Now when it says servants, it doesn't mean menial house servants. It means ministers of state. And Pharaoh says, "Can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit?" The NIV translates that as the spirit of God. But then the NIV makes a note, "or of the gods, in whom there is a spirit of the gods." So there's a question here. Does the phrase mean that Pharaoh is looking for someone who has the spirit of Yahweh, the true God in him, or is he looking for somebody who has the spirit of one of his multitudinous Egyptian gods? Well, I don't think it makes a big difference either way. The NIV Study Bible says that Pharaoh is not referring to the true God, Joseph's God, Yahweh's. Not referring to that. He's referring to his pagan gods, says the NIV Study Bible. But Adam Clark says that Pharaoh was referring to Joseph's God, the true God. And this was what he says. "Ruach Elohim, the spirit of God, Ruach Elohim," the identical words in Genesis 1-2, and certainly to be understood here as in the preceding place. In other words, we should interpret Ruach Elohim in the same way as we do in Genesis 1-2, where it says the spirit of God hovered over the waters. "If the Egyptians were idolaters," Clark continues, "they acknowledged Joseph's God, and it is not to be supposed that they only became acquainted with him on this occasion. The knowledge of the true God was in Egypt long before, but it is very likely that though they acknowledged his influence with respect to Joseph, as they saw most clearly that he acted under an influence far beyond that of their magicians, for he interpreted dreams which they could not, yet they might, notwithstanding, have their gods many, and their lords many at this time, for we know that in religious matters they were exceedingly corrupt afterwards." So what Clark is saying is, Pharaoh could have recognized that Joseph had a god that was a pretty strong god because he could interpret dreams, but like all polytheists, they say, well, he's a good god, Yahweh's a good god, but there's lots of other gods too. He's not the only, he's a good god, he's a powerful god, he's an interpreting dream god, but he's not the only god because there's other gods too. And I probably suspect that that's the case of Pharaoh here. He thinks that Joseph has got a pretty good God, but he's not the only God. We go down to Genesis 41, verses 39 through 40. "So Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne will I be greater than you.' You shall be over my house." Pharaoh means over all of Egypt. People going to do Joseph homage, and Pharaoh didn't care that Joseph used to be a slave. He's interested in Joseph's skill, not his status. That reminds me of a review of a movie I just saw, The Professor and the Madman or something, Mel Gibson. Some guy back in 19th century, I think it was England, was trying to, it might not have been England, I didn't watch the movie, but this guy was trying to make a dictionary, I believe it was England, a dictionary of all English words and give the etymology of all English words, which is, of course, an impossible task. But this professor ran into a crazy guy in a prison who was insane. He was in an insane asylum, and he was able to help him on this. Well, when the professor tried to give credit to the insane guy for helping him, all the academic stuffed shirts at Oxford wouldn't stand for that. Reminds me of Edwin Hubble, the greatest astronomer of the 20th century, who never had a formal college degree, out in California, that did a big bunch of breakthroughs in astrophysics. He had a high school education. He turned out to be just as brilliant as all the astrophysicists out there, and they just couldn't quite give him credit for all the stuff he was coming up with. Well, finally they did. They gave him credit, even though he only had a high school education. So it is smart managers, smart political leaders who give credit to people's skills, not their status. I think of Justinian in the Byzantine Empire in the early 6th century AD. His wife, Theodora, was a famous empress who had a lot of impact on political affairs back then. She had a lot of power, a lot of influence on Justinian, and she was from an actress family, and as a result was accused of being a prostitute all her life because actresses back then had very low status, and yet she rose to great power. So Joseph, he was a slave, but now he's number two in Egypt. Took him 13 years to get there. We go down to Genesis 41, 41 through 43. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put the gold necklace around his neck. He had him ride in his second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee." And he, Pharaoh, set him, Joseph, over all the land of Egypt. Now, these three symbols of authority that we see here were given to Joseph: a signet ring, garments, that's royal garments, and a necklace. Three symbols of royal authority. And we see this in other scriptures. A signet ring is shown to be a symbol of authority in Esther 3:10. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. You know the story in Esther, how God turned the persecution of Haman against the Jews into an humiliation for Haman when Mordecai, the Jewish advisor, was given the signet ring. The king, that's Xerxes, took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. So that signet ring is a symbol of authority. And so Haman could sign documents with that sucker. Sign it with the king's name. Authority. Garments. And likewise, Joseph had a signet ring from the Pharaoh. And also garments of fine linen. Esther 6:11. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai. So Haman had to give a symbol of royal authority, a robe, and arrayed Mordecai, led him on horseback. So that was another symbol of authority. And the gold necklace also, this is in the case of Daniel, Daniel 5:7. The king called aloud to the conjurers, that's Nebuchadnezzar, the Chaldeans and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck." There's the clothes, the royal garments, which are typically purple, and also a necklace of gold. And have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. So Nebuchadnezzar, when he's talking about giving somebody authority, says a necklace of gold will be a symbol of that. So a necklace is a symbol of authority, and Joseph had that from the Pharaoh. Daniel 5:16, "But I personally have heard about you," Nebuchadnezzar talking to Daniel, "that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscriptions and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple," there's the cloth, "and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." That's just a repeat. Necklace of gold is authority. In the same chapter, Daniel 5:29, "Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that now he had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." So, necklace of gold is a symbol. So Joseph, he was walking around in tall cotton. Verse 43, the Pharaoh had him, Joseph, ride in his second chariot. That either means that he was riding next to Pharaoh, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggest, or perhaps he was riding behind Pharaoh. Either way, it was a position of high honor. And then the heralds were all saying, "Bow the knee," or as the NIV translates it, "Make way." Make way, that's a weak translation. The NIV note, as an alternative translation, says, "Bow down." That's more like it, I think. Bow the knee. At least it sounds better in English. Bow the knee. And so now Joseph is set up over all the land of Egypt. We go now to Genesis 41, verses 44 and 45. "Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt.' Then Pharaoh named Joseph Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt." Now, Pharaoh gave Joseph a name. Unfortunately, nobody knows what this name means, according to the NIV Study Bible and Adam Clark. However, John Gill, who is a rabbinic expert, he quotes the rabbis, the Jewish rabbis, who translated that Egyptian name as, "To whom hidden things are revealed." Zaphnath-Paneah, to whom hidden things are revealed. Well, that makes sense. Jameson Foster Brown, on the contrary, translates it as, quote, a wise man fleeing from pollution, but basically nobody knows. So that's a great Bible trivia question. What was Joseph's Egyptian name? Zephanath-Paneah. Now, Asenath was the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. She was given to Joseph as a wife. Now, her Egyptian name probably means she belongs to the goddess Neith, N-E-I-T-H. That was a well-known goddess back then. She belongs to the goddess Neith. And so Joseph is marrying a pagan wife who belongs to the goddess Neith. Ooh, that doesn't sound good. And people say Joseph is to blame. Well, first of all, what do? The Pharaoh gives you a wife, and you say, nah, Pharaoh, I don't think I like her. You going to do that? I don't think I would do that. But a lot of commentators feel like Joseph did a no-no here. Here's one attempt to exculpate Joseph. Well, priest of On can be translated as prince of On. And so Asenath was a daughter of the prince of On. Well, I don't care. She's a daughter of a priest or a prince. She's probably going to be a pagan. There weren't very many believers of Yahweh back there. One of my commentators said that Joseph would never marry into a pagan priest family. Really? I'm not so sure about that. You know, her father may have been pagan, but maybe Asenath wasn't pagan. In other words, all daughters don't follow their fathers. Or possibly Joseph could have convinced her of the truth of Yahweh before he married her. I don't know. It doesn't bother me that he married Asenath. Here's another attempt to exculpate Joseph. Potipharah might be a worship of the true God, these people say. He might not be a priest of Ra, the sun god. Here's Jameson Fawcett and Brown's idea, quote, on being founded by an Arab colony, On, that's the city, not the preposition On, but the city of On, being founded by an Arab colony, Potipharah, like Jethro, priest of Midian, might be a worshiper of the true God. Now, I don't know why, just because On is founded by Arabs, that a priest there might be a worshiper of Yahweh, because there were some Arabs that worshiped Yahweh. I don't know. But if this was true, Jameson Fawcett Brown continued, thus Joseph, a pious man, will be freed from the charge of marrying an idolatress for worldly ends. Well, why would you charge Joseph with marrying an idolatress for worldly ends? He wasn't seeking worldly ends. The woman was given to him by the Pharaoh he didn't ask for. And how's he going to refuse that gift without getting himself in a world of trouble? Well, anyway, I'm not going to worry about Joseph's mixed marriage here. I don't think that's a big problem. Let's look at her father's name, Potipharah is how I've been pronouncing it. Who knows how you pronounce it? It has nothing to do with Potiphar, by the way. Potipharah means he whom the sun god Ra has given. He whom the sun god Ra has given. Which makes me think he's not a priest of Yahweh. He was a priest in On. On is a famous city. We need to know something about it. It's now 10 miles northeast of modern Cairo, as the NIV Study Bible says. According to Bing.com/maps, it's really a suburb of Cairo. You can still go there. There's one famous obelisk still left in pretty good shape that's several thousands of years old. The dates in Egypt will just blow your mind. But it's still there. It's the only thing that's left. And Cairo, of course, is near the Nile River. On is near the Nile River, where the Nile breaks into several branches in Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt, of course, is northern Egypt. And Cairo, or On, is where all the great pyramids are, a little bit in the general vicinity there. It's just right north of Memphis, which was also an early capital of the Egyptians. The Greeks called On Heliopolis. You can see the Greek there, helium for sun and polis for city, metropolis. Heliopolis, city of the sun. Why is that? Well, because On was an important center for the worship of the sun god Ra, as the NIV Study Bible says. Also, the worship of Aton started there, and those gods get mixed up. Ra, Aton, sometimes you hear. It was the capital of Egypt in the pre-dynastic period, thousands of years ago, thousands of years B.C. I forgot the dates exactly, but this is where Egyptian mythology, which is really advanced, it's really wild if you ever read anything about Egyptian mythology, and it started there. A lot of it started right there at On. So it's a famous city. Now, whether Joseph was there, I don't know. Nobody knows. At least I don't know. I've seen a bunch of speculations one way or the other as to where he was operating from. Doesn't matter, because it's not decided yet by modern scholars. Now, Joseph was said to go forth from wherever he was. In verse 45, he went forth. Why? To see what the condition of the land was, to prepare for the famine, to see where the food was and where he was going to store it. We go now to verse 46, Genesis 41. Now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. Now I'm assuming this is the same went out. He went out one time over the land of Egypt. John Gill says, well, he could have gone out twice, and this verse 46 could be his second grand tour, whereas verse 45 was his first. I don't think so. And that date there of Joseph's, not the date, but the age of Joseph that's given there, he was 30 years old. Since we know he was 17 years old from another scripture, which I don't have in front of me now, but he was 17 years old when he came into Egypt as a teenage slave, and now he's 30 years old, his second command in Egypt. That's 13 years. In 13 years, Joseph went from being a teenage slave in prison to being the second in command in Egypt, right under the Pharaoh, who was one of the most powerful figures in ancient society. It's amazing. Pretty good career path. Genesis 41, 47 through 49, we continue. During the 7 years of plenty, the land brought forth abundantly. So he, that's Joseph, gathered all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and placed the food in the cities. He placed in every city the food from its own surrounding fields. Thus Joseph stored up grain in great abundance like the sand of the sea until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. Now when it says he gathered all the food, it means all the food that was planned, the one-fifth, the 20%. It doesn't mean 100%. There's one more example of how all does not always all mean all, like certain name it and claim it word of faith charismatic preachers used to preach back when I was in the charismatic movement. They would always say, all always means all. No, it does not. That is the easiest thing in the world to refute, and here's one example of it right here. There's a million ways to refute it. The grain was said to be unmeasurable. Joseph couldn't measure it anymore, which is pretty amazing. That means there was enough grain for surrounding countries, which was important because the grain had to feed Jacob and the patriarchs to keep them alive so that Israel could be in existence for the Son of God to get born into. We go down to Genesis 41, verses 51 through 52. Now before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. He named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Now Manasseh and Ephraim are going to be names of two of the famous 12 tribes of Israel, so we might want to make a note of this. Why was Manasseh named Manasseh? Joseph said, because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. He's forgotten his roots. He's forgotten all the things his brothers did to him. Manasseh sounds like and may be derived from the Hebrew for forget, as the NIV Study Bible says. That's close enough for me, although it sounds like it's questionable, the Hebrew translation, but that's close enough. Manasseh means forgetful. In verse 52, he named the second kid, the second son, Ephraim. Now, Ephraim sounds like the Hebrew for twice fruitful, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, what does that mean, twice fruitful? Well, it could refer to the birth of Joseph's two sons. He had one son, Manasseh, was fruitful. Then he had two sons, Ephraim, and so he is twice fruitful. Or, as John Gill says, it could refer to Joseph's honors, his responsibilities, and his elevation in Egypt as being the second in command behind Pharaoh. And so Joseph says, I'm not only fruitful, I'm twice fruitful. I'm a big shot now. I'm 50-50 on that one. It could go either way, in my opinion, but that's okay. We just remember Ephraim is fruitful. Some people speculate that Ephraim and Manasseh were actually twins, but that's just speculation. We now go to Genesis 41, verses 53 through 57, and we'll finish this audio. When the 7 years of plenty which had been in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said, then there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said to the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you, you shall do. Now when it says, I don't know whether there's a time sequence here, that in all the land there was Egypt, there was bread, then oops, all of a sudden the bread ran out, and so Pharaoh said, go to Joseph, he'll get you some more. Or maybe it's all just lumped together, and it says, in Egypt there was bread, because Joseph gave the bread to the Egyptians because of his storehouse scheme. Whichever. The Pharaoh says, look, I got Joseph in charge. You go to him. Verse 56, Genesis 41. When the famine was spread over all the face of the earth, then Joseph opened all the storehouses. It looks like Joseph let them just eat normally until their food ran out. Save the grain in the storehouse till it was necessary to distribute it. Then Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. The people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. Notice that Joseph sold the grain. He didn't give it away. I said this in the previous audio. I hope that Joseph took that grain from the people by buying it on the open market and then selling it back. That would be just. If he just took it and expropriated it as a tax, it wouldn't be so just. There was a third option. He could have taken the grain by eminent domain, what we call eminent domain. He says it's a necessity, it's a state emergency. We're taking the grain from you, but we are going to pay you a just price for it, which is not quite as gentle as buying the grain on the open market. But at any rate, if the people made a lot of money selling that grain to the state, to Joseph, during the years of plenty, they then could use that money to buy it back during the time of famine. So Joseph is not increasing Egypt's national debt by selling this grain. Verse 57, the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. All the other countries of the earth did not have the Nile River to keep them going. They didn't have the storehouses of grain to keep them going. Gill says that this famine that's mentioned, the 7 years of famine, is also referred to by the famous Roman writer, Ovid, as also does Apollodorus. Here's his quote, very probable that to this 7 years drought in Egypt Ovid refers, which he makes to be nine years, as also does Apollodorus. I don't know how they went from 7 to 9 years. Joseph, in delivering the people from mass starvation, some say, because he did that Joseph became worshipped as a god. Now in verse 56, when the famine was spread over the face of the earth, we see from this that it's not just the Nile that caused the famine. It wasn't just the lack of height, elevation of the rising of the Nile that caused the famine, because that would only cause famine in Egypt, not all over the world, all over the ancient Near East there. Probably what happened, because there was a famine everywhere, the Nile didn't rise. And so that then, of course, hurt Egypt very badly. In other words, it was not the other way around. It wasn't the fact that the Nile didn't rise that there was a famine in Egypt. It was the fact that there was a drought all over the world that the Nile didn't rise, and then that caused the famine in Egypt. Now, I'm assuming that the famine was all over the world, but in verse 57, that word earth can be translated as land. Verse 56, when the famine was spread over all the face of the land, verse 57, the people of all the land came to Egypt. In other words, the idea that the storehouses helped the people in Egypt. I don't think any of the translations translated as land, but rather earth. The word is ambiguous. You can go either way. And the reason I think it's the earth is because Jacob and his sons weren't in the land of Egypt. They were in Israel, in Canaan, but they were still affected by the famine. They had to go to Egypt. So we're going to assume this is an ancient Near East drought and famine all over the place. Now, when it says all over the earth, of course, that doesn't mean in Antarctica and in South Carolina and in France and England. It means all over Moses' world, the earth from Moses' perspective. He's the writer of this story. It's referring to the Middle East, Canaan, Syria, Arabia. Now, the fact that Jacob helped everybody in the world on the face of the earth, the NIV Study Bible makes an interesting point that this story illustrates how Abraham's seed were to be a blessing to the whole world. Remember, the famous promise to Abraham was threefold, land, offspring, and blessings to the nations, as in Genesis 12, blessing to the nation. Well, here, Joseph, he's Abraham's seed, and he's a blessing to the nation. He kept him alive during a famine. I think ultimately it was fulfilled in Solomon's time when Solomon, all of his trade, his wisdom, and his knowledge, and his wealth, helped everybody in the ancient Middle East, political stability, economic prosperity, blessing to the ancient world then. I think that's how that was fulfilled in the Old Testament. Of course, the ultimate spiritual fulfillment, Abraham's offspring are Christians, believers in Christ, both Jew and Gentile, who then become a blessing to the whole world because we bring the news of salvation to everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, on that happy note, we are now finished with Genesis chapter 41. That prepares us for Genesis 42. I'm going to do the whole chapter, verses 1 through 38. And in this chapter, we will see Joseph meeting his brothers in Egypt, which is sort of an emotional dramatic thing. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.